The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So I want to give a talk on the topic that I gave at the retreat. I gave at the heart of the retreat, kind of when people are most concentrated, most still, most maybe receptive. So it's a little bit considered maybe a little bit more, I don't know, I'd want to say advanced teaching, but more higher teaching or something. Maybe a little more confusing teaching. So maybe you'll come along. So it's the teachings about the Buddha gave to a man named Bahiya. And this particular discourse is kind of the theme song, one of the theme songs for the Vipassana movement. People often like to give talks about it because it points to something very essential about Vipassana practice itself. But it also points to something very provocative, very interesting about the nature of being a human being. What is it to be human? One of the great perennial questions that gets answered indirectly. That question doesn't get asked, but it reflects back in a very interesting way on this amazing question, who are we? For those of us who don't know for sure, you should listen. So, Bahiya was a spiritual teacher, renunciant, who lived at the time of the Buddha, and he seemed to have been some renown. It said that he had 500 disciples, and he lived far from where the Buddha was. He lived on the coast of India, and I think the story helps if thinking about Bahiya as a spiritual teacher with a lot of followers to give him the benefit of the doubt and assume that he is a spiritually mature person, someone who's matured. And it means perhaps someone who's mature like that, there's a lot of integrity, a lot of self-understanding, self-reflection, probably spent a lot of time thinking about or studying some of the important issues around spiritual life, meditation life. Someone who had learned to let go of a lot of the common things that people cling to quite tightly. Most spiritual traditions put some emphasis on letting go, not holding on to, you know, our attachments to possessions or people or things or variety of things. So probably he'd done a lot of inner work and he was mature. And part of that maturity was a willingness to look at himself and question his own attainment, where he was at. And so he asked himself a question. He said, of the people who are fully awakened or who are on the path to full freedom, full liberation, am I one of those people? So that's, you know, a good question. And as the story is told, a deva, a little kind of minor god, came to him. And my way of interpreting this is that we have sources of understanding and wisdom within us that is not necessarily part of our conscious, discursive, thinking mind. And so he couldn't take credit for it in the usual way, but some inner wisdom spoke up, and so, you know, he has to attribute it somewhere, so he attributed it to something external, a deva, in my interpretation. So this deva said to him, no. You are not fully awakened, nor are you on the path of full awakening. So perhaps some of you have had that inner voice. And so then Bahiya, being a mature person, said, well, if that's the case, is there anyone who is fully awakened or knows the path to full awakening? And the deva said, yes, there is. There is a Buddha in this world and who is fully awakened. He knows that path. Where is he? Well, he's in middle India somewhere up there in Savasti, Varanasi area. And so then, because of his maturity, whatever that is, and his honesty and the sense of importance in the spiritual life, there and then headed out for Varanasi, It's a long walk, long distance to go in India. The discourse says he walked it in one day and one night. I interpret this to mean that he didn't waste any time. He just went directly there. Maybe it was a colloquial expression back then. And he got to Varanasi probably in the morning time, because he asked for, where's the Buddha? And he said, oh, he's there in this place where the monks live in the woods. And so he went there quickly and asked, if he came across the Buddha. And he said, the Buddha, I want to ask you an important question. I want to ask you to give me the teachings, your teachings, succinctly and brief. The Buddha said, this is not the time for me to teach. I'm about to go off for breakfast. I'm about to go off for my alms round. Once a day, the Buddha goes out with his bowl into the village and to gather food that he's going to eat for that day. So it's kind of important outing. So the Buddha said, this is not the time. And Bahia said, you know, asked again. And the Buddha said, second time, this is not the time. And then Bahia said something significant. It is hard to know for sure what dangers there may be for the Blessed One's life, or what dangers there may be for mine. Teach me the Dharma. Teach me the Dharma, O well-gone one, that will be for my long-term welfare and happiness. You don't know when you're going to die, in other words. You don't know when the Buddha, your teacher, is going to die or anything. Well, how many opportunities do you have? You know, give me awakening, but not yet. I'll get to practice eventually, you know. And maybe there'll be an eventually for you, but you don't know how much longer you have to live, and what do you consider to be most important? So this is a man who had done that reflection, maybe as part of his maturity. He reflected what was most important for him, and what did he want to do in this life? And this is something he was really serious about. I don't want to lose this opportunity. So then, hearing that, the Buddha was willing to give in. And so this is what the Buddha told this man. Maybe the Buddha perceived that this was a mature person who was ready for some kind of deeper teaching, direct teaching. And so he kind of said it very directly. Then, Bahia, you should train yourself thus. So first, this is very significant. The first thing he says, you should train yourself thus. He didn't kind of tell him, this is the nature of the universe. Let me explain to you how it all is. You know, this is the truth. Let me tell you what the truth is. He doesn't say that. He says, this is how you should train yourself. This is how you should practice. In relationship to what is seen, let there only be the seen. In relationship to what is heard, let there only be the heard. In relationship to what is sensed, let there only be the sensed. In relationship to what is cognized, let there only be the cognized. This is how you should train yourself. So that's the first half of what he said. So when you hear something, we don't often just hear something. We immediately put labels on it. We associate it with things we've heard like that in the past. We have associations, we have reactions, judgments, and there's a whole cascade of responses that occur in the mind. It's actually somewhat rare that we really hear something and leave it alone, just to be the heard. We might hear some beautiful music coming from our neighbor's house, and it's not just sound, beautiful music, but it's we recognize it as a particular music we listened to when we were teens, and it brings back memories. Or it reminds us of our neighbor who is always disrespectful to us, always turns on that music at 10 o'clock at night and has no care and concern for the other people around. And so then it's associated with the anger that we have and the you know, the sense of being harmed. Or we might kind of start thinking about, I really want that music for myself. I wonder if I can go on iTunes and buy it. But then I don't have an iPod player. I don't have a computer that connects me. So I think I, you know, need to figure out how to do that. But that's not so easy to do. I don't know much about computers, let alone I don't have a job that really allows me to buy these things. So maybe I should think about getting a job. But that has its problems, and probably I should join the Tea Party. So that's an example of not leaving the herd at just the herd. You know, it goes on like that, you know. And the sad thing is it doesn't stop like that. Sometimes the mind can go on for days. One association after another leads this and that. But just leave something very simple in its pristine simplicity, just a herd, just a scene, to see something as it is, just as it is, in the raw simplicity of it, before all the association, judgments, reactions, responses that can take over. So much so sometimes we don't actually see what's there. What we see is our overlay on top of it, our projections on top of it. A good percentage of the time when we see people, we don't see the people just as they are. We see often there's a layer of interpretation, concepts, ideas that we overlay on it. When I was 19, I traveled in Morocco. And it was kind of the first non-Western country I traveled in as kind of an adult on my own without my parents. And back then, I don't know how it is now, but way back then, there was a lot of the people wearing traditional Moroccan clothes. Men were wearing these yalabas, these kind of long robes. And I noticed in the time I was in Morocco an unusual feeling kind of in my mind. My mind, as I walked around the streets, I felt kind of lighter, kind of more, a little more open, a little more kind of something I wasn't familiar with. And after a while it dawned on me that the little lightness I felt was because a certain mental activity that I was used to doing, that I was kind of unconscious about, wasn't operating. And that was because I had no reference point for men wearing yalabas in these traditional clothes. It didn't fit into my cultural kind of understanding. I didn't judge anybody. I just let it be as they were. And whereas I'd realized, and seeing that, being there in Morocco, I said, well, actually, here in the West, you know, I have these little kind of evaluations that are kind of like judgments of people. You know, that's a jock, that's a, you know, whatever, you know, that's this kind of person, that kind of person. You know, I had a category for many, many people. And I didn't just leave people alone, but I put them in these categories that required a certain mental activity. And my mind got lighter when I didn't do that. So in the scene, just a scene. So that's the training the Buddha offered, and that's a training we try to do in Vipassana. Just leave it that way. Interestingly, the last thing he says is in the cognized, just the cognized. So when there's a thought, just let it be a thought. It's rare that we see a thought as a thought. Often we think our thoughts are much more. Sometimes people's relationship to thinking is thoughts are more substantial than reality, more meaningful than reality. One of the great clichés in our Vipassana movement is the cliché or the little saying, the thoughts of your mother are not your mother. We have all these ideas of people and we get caught up in those ideas. We have ideas about what reality is and we get caught up in those ideas. And many of you, I think, have probably had the experience of thinking about something, interpreting it something one way, and later finding out that it actually wasn't that way. And so you didn't see it just as a thought that arises. You saw it as being as true. So you interpreted it that way. One of the great values of being mindful, strongly mindful, is to be able to watch the arising of a thought or interpretation in the mind and see it as such. So if you're seeing someone walking down the street and you do have an interpretation for them of them, and your mind is very busy, it's very hard to separate out the interpretation from what you see in the person. It's all kind of there together as one. But if you're still enough or mindful enough, And you can watch see the person, and you watch in the wake of the sight the arising of an idea about that person, and you see it as an idea, that gives you an opportunity to question, is this an accurate idea, an accurate interpretation? My mind is creating this. Let's check this out. Let's find out. Let's now, you know, maybe it's accurate, maybe it's not, but let's have some investigations and deeper kind of second looking at the situation to see if it's actually real. This is one of the great values of doing Vipassana. We can't expect to stop thinking all the time, cognizing, but it's possible to see a cognition as a cognition and thereby have a lot more wisdom about it, a lot more space or how we relate to it. So in the cognized, just the cognized. So I might hear beautiful music, and I can't just leave it as music, just hearing and hearing. But I could see it as hearing, and then separately I can see the cognizing occurs. And teasing those apart gives you a lot of power, a lot of choice about how we relate to things. So that was the first instruction to Bahia. In the seeing, just the seeing, the heard, just the heard, the cognized, just the cognized. Then he went on, and the next part could be seen as referring back or saying something about who are we? Who do you think you are? This is how you should train yourself. When for you, there will be only the seen in reference to the seen, only the heard in reference to the heard, only the sensed in reference to the sensed, only the cognized in reference to the cognized, then, Bahia, there is no you in connection with that. No you in connection to that. So, imagine you're in a place that's completely silent. Beautifully silent, refreshingly silent. And then you say to your friend, I wonder, is there any sounds around here? Guess what? What's the answer now? The answer, yes, you just spoke. You made the sound. Is there any sounds around right here now? And how would I know? Where would I find that sound? Oh yeah, I hear a sound right now. There is sound. I don't believe there's such a thing as silence because I hear a sound. As I'm looking for a sound, I hear the sound. As I talk about it, I hear the sound. And I wonder what kind of sound. I wonder what the true nature of myself is in relationship to this sound. I wonder what the true nature of sound is. I can't believe there's any alternative to sound because I won't stop talking. If we're trying to understand the nature of silence while we're constantly talking about it and searching for it, guess what? The silence is not there. Same thing in the mind. If we're constantly talking to ourselves and asking ourselves questions and searching and thinking about who am I? Who am I really? Then your answer is going to be limited or be shaped or influenced by that inner chatter that's constantly going. And in fact, you'll think, many people will think, that something about the inner voice that's thinking, reflecting, imagining, inquiring, engaged in this kind of search, the one who's searching for who am I, that must be there, you must be able to find who you really are. The inner talking, the inner searching is constantly going on. It's an activity. And since it's always going on, it must reflect back. It must belong to who I really am. In the same way that if you're always talking in the silence, you know, it's only in the talking you can find the real silence, right? Because there is nothing else. Something like that. You're following enough? So in the seeing, just the seeing, not only do you not make an association or idea that you overlay on top of your friend that you're looking at, But you also don't create an association that I am the one who's seeing. It isn't like someone else is seeing, so it's accurate enough. But it's an activity of the mind to claim, I'm the one who's seeing. The mind is talking. The mind is to itself. The mind is cognizing. The mind is an active. It's possible to see and not relate it back to the person who's seeing. Just seeing is going on. And I hope that some of you have had the experience of looking at something and afterwards realizing that you were just looking and there was no person who was consciously or self-consciously seeing. And it's refreshing, it's kind of lighter to do that. It's not necessary to posit a self in order to see. And once we associate a self, then to that seeing, it's a magnet to all kinds of ideas of what we have, of what it means to be a self that we might have. What if that part of the mind is silent? We still see. If we don't keep that mind silent, or if we don't keep this, if we don't give up the searching, maybe we can't really see the silence or the stillness or something. So to just see, and in the seeing just a seeing, without having a self in relationship, in the heard, no self in relationship to it, and in the cognize what the mind thinks, without creating a self, not creating a thinker. I'm the one who's thinking. It's my wonderful thought. It's my terrible thought. But it's embarrassing that I should think this. Or, boy, I just mean, this is fantastic. I can't wait to show off my great idea. Just a thought bubbles up. You could have the world's ugliest thought. No one's ever had an uglier thought than yours. It's just a thought. Look, an ugly thought. You don't have to say, boy, did I have an ugly thought. Or a beautiful thought. Just a thought. Why would you want to do that? Why not? What's wrong about making it my thought? There's a place for that. There's a place for taking responsibility and ownership for what goes on. There's also a time and a place to leave it alone, to know how to give the mind a vacation from all the doing. Maybe some of you have been around a person who didn't stop speaking, and you wish they would. Give it a break. Some of you have been the person, especially if you're a meditator. And you realize, I can't, it goes on and on in there. I can't believe it. Give it a break. It's exhausting. So when for you, there will be only the seeing in reference to the seeing, then there is no you in connection with that. When there is no you in connection with that, when there's no creation of you, constructing of you, associating you, judging you, just there is no you in connection to that experience, there is no you there. When there's no you there, you are neither here nor yonder nor between the two. Just this is the end of suffering. So the end of suffering in this passage has something to do with not making a self, constructing a self in relationship to what's going on. And here he says, if you experience something without associating to self, constructing a self in relationship to it, just let it be the seeing, just a seeing, then there's no here. There's no place where there's a self. If I'm speaking in the silence, you can ask, where is the speaker? You say, oh, it's here. And as soon as you say there's here, the speaker here, then there's you, the listener is out there. But if I don't speak, where is a speaker found? If there's no, I was a speaker, if I, you know, but when I in the silence, there is no speaker. You won't find a speaker. The speaker is not in a location. And since a speaker is not in a location, there's no listeners out there. If the mind's activity of creating a self, or the searching for self, or making a self, that activity, that stress, that tension, that pressure, that agitation, that churning is not there, then there can be the thing that's seen is seen. But there's no self in any location in reference to it. And to experience something, to see, to hear, to cognize, without a location, to be aware without a location, is a very interesting experience. It's hard to do because generally we localize ourselves. When I was a new practitioner, if someone asked me, "Where are you aware?" I would have pointed to my head. After I practiced for some years, and someone asked me, "Where are you?" I would have pointed to my torso. Now, where are you aware? Where's awareness? I would have pointed to my torso. It's more embodied, more full, much more full than just in the head, thinking or something. And after some more years of practice, if someone asked me, where's awareness? I would just take my arms, both arms, and kind of spread them really wide, kind of, and include everything. It's everywhere. Awareness is everywhere. I mean, not logically, but experientially. If I don't locate myself as being here, then there's no here and no there. There is no me in relationship to what's heard. It isn't that I'm, what's heard is in me, or I'm in what's heard, or what's heard is in awareness, or awareness is in what's heard. It doesn't make sense to talk about location. There is just this freedom, this openness, this expansiveness that has no locus, no location. Awareness without location. As soon as we want to say, it's me, we're located. As soon as there's a searching for who I am, we're located. And so this is how it reflects back on this classic search, who am I? In the very asking, we bias the answer. And so we can't answer the question while we're searching. We have to be silent. But then, in the silence, you don't ask the question. You don't need the question. You're free of the question and the answer. So in the seen, just the seen, in the heard, just the heard, in the cognized, beautiful world of thoughts, just the cognized, and allowing this whole show of experience to arise and to pass, to appear and to disappear, without any of the pressure or tension or grasping or craving that goes into making a self, making another, solidifying anything, resisting anything, grasping anything, trying to make things different than what they are or not different than what they are. Just letting awareness be, letting experience be there, without reference to me or you. So, and then the sutra goes on a little bit more, and one of the more interesting parts of the end of the sutra is Bahia goes off then, and apparently immediately hearing this is fully awakened. And then as he's walking down the road, a wild bull comes and gores him and he dies. So I think, maybe it really happened, but My interpretation is, again, that the people who composed this text wanted to drive home this very important teaching. You don't know how much time you have. Better get it when you can. So I hope you get it. And I hope that as you get it, you disappear. In the way we're talking about today. So, thank you so much.